language is everything. It's the air we breathe. It's the blood that flows through our veins.
The legislature passes a bill officially recognizing Alaska Native languages. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 21st. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, UAF pieces together how a saline solution was wrongly injected into students during a clinical procedures class.
We don't know exactly why and how it happened. I think that that's one of the things that our investigator is going to try and help us figure out.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Last night, the Alaska State Legislature failed to meet their 90-day deadline after the House and Senate couldn't reach an agreement on a major education bill. Lawmakers stayed on the floor until 4 a.m. trying to wrap up their work, but it was not enough. Now they're back at the Capitol for a 91st day of session, trying to hammer out a deal. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez is there with them right now. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
Has any progress been made on the education bill?
The Senate just finished their debate on the education bill. The bill before them was introduced by the governor, and it's a major priority for him. It's a pretty sprawling piece of legislation, and it includes provisions that make it easier to establish charter schools, it gets rid of the high school exit exam, all sorts of things. But the big hang-up is the education funding question. The governor started the session with an $85 increase to the base student allocation in it, with future increases promised. That's the amount of money a school gets for each student, and every $100 increase is worth about $25 million. The House more than doubled that number, with an education package worth about $250 million over 3 years. The Senate went even higher, but they offered that money as one-time funding. That's where things blew up. Many education advocates have been screaming for that money to be put into the base student allocation because it gives schools a lot more security. If the money is a one-time thing, there's no guarantee that school districts won't have to come back and ask for it again to help make up their budget gaps and avoid teacher layoffs. But the debate on the education bill was really a pro forma thing. Democrats offered amendments to the bill, but none were adopted. The real fight will really happen when the bill gets sent back to the House, because it could trigger a pretty unusual negotiating process called a free conference committee.
Well, Alexandra, help us understand what that is.
Last night, as everyone was kind of slap happy, it was clear that the Senate and House just did not see eye to eye on education funding. I heard one legislator describe it as a committee with superpowers. The House will send a few of their people, the Senate will send theirs, and then they hammer out their differences in a way that should work for both bodies. In a normal conference committee, you pick and you choose the bits that each side likes. In free conference, you have the power to completely add new stuff and to dramatically change the bill. It's something that's really only used when there's a major impasse. But because the committee has the power to add entirely new language to the bill, there's a risk for things to get pretty messy.
Are there any other hang-ups beyond funding for this education package?
There are a few. The House doesn't like that the Senate took out language that lengthens the probationary period for urban teachers before they can get tenure. They also don't like that the Senate version requires municipalities to take on a bigger burden in education funding. That could result in increased property taxes in some communities, which really doesn't play well in an election year.
So, Alexandra, how long can the session go at this point?
Even though voters put a 90-day limit on the legislative session a few years back, the legislature can meet up to 121 days without running afoul of the Constitution. Obviously, people want to get out as quickly as possible, but since they've already blown the deadline, they may as well try to get things done as best they can and finish their work on other bills that were at risk of dying.
How much work is left unfinished aside from education?
Well, the other two priority bills passed this weekend. The governor asked the legislature to put a few billion dollars toward the pension system and to pass a bill that allows a massive natural gas pipeline to be built when the session first started. They did that. That's done. That's off their plate. But there are still dozens of lawmakers' personal bills they got close to passing, but then were held up either as leverage in negotiations or were just caught up in the logjam as things fell apart this past week. Those cover everything from a popular crime reform bill to one that would allow the DMV to offer license plates with bears on them.
All right. Well, thanks for keeping us updated, Alexandra.
My pleasure, Lori.
That was APRN's Capitol correspondent, Alexandra Gutierrez. Because the legislature did not meet its midnight deadline, three citizens' initiatives are expected to be moved from the August primary to the November general election. The switch would happen because of a constitutional rule requiring a 120-day waiting period after a legislative session before an initiative can be put to a vote. It would affect ballot questions aimed towards slowing down the proposed Pebble Mine, to regulate marijuana like alcohol, and to hike the minimum wage. The rule does not apply to referenda, so a measure to repeal the new oil tax law would stay on the August ballot. The rescheduling of initiatives is expected to help the anti-repeal effort, which the oil industry has sunk millions of dollars into. That's because the initiatives are expected to bring more liberal-leaning voters to the polls, and that increased turnout will no longer affect the primary. With the addition of the initiatives, the November ballot will be especially packed because of the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race. Supporters of a bill to make 20 Alaska Native languages official state languages organized a 15-hour sit-in protest at the Capitol yesterday. Their dedication paid off early this morning when the Alaska Senate passed the measure on an 18-2 vote. It now heads to Governor Sean Parnell for his signature. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Dozens of people of all ages and races, many wearing their Easter finest, gathered in the hall outside Senator Liesl McGuire's office. The Anchorage Republican and chair of the Senate Rules Committee had the power to put House Bill 216 on the Senate's calendar. But with the end of the legislative session looming, the bill's supporters worried it was getting caught up in last-minute, behind-the-scenes politics. The group started their vigil just after noon, singing, dancing, and playing drums, and talking about why Alaska Native languages are so important.
Our language is everything. It's the air we breathe. It's the blood that flows through our veins.
Lance Twitchell is a professor of Native languages at the University of Alaska Southeast. HB 216 would add the state's indigenous languages to a statute created by a 1998 voter initiative, which made English the official language of Alaska. While the bill is largely symbolic, Twitchell said it's important to recognize all languages as equal.
That's all we want, is equal value. And there's nothing wrong with standing up and saying that. It takes a lot of courage to do that, and it takes a lot of something else to try and go against that.
Many elders who attended the sit-in recalled being punished as children for speaking their languages. Irene Cadiente of Juneau said her teachers would hit her with a ruler when they caught her speaking Tlingit.
Sometimes I wonder when my hand hurt. Is it on account of me speaking Tlingit? My hands were rulered. Is that why it hurts? I never forget that.
Cadiente said she's proud that her great-grandchildren are now learning to speak the language. Heather Burge, a student in the Native Languages program at UAS, said she didn't understand how HB 216 could become controversial.
We should be at the point where this should be a non-issue, but it's still scary to some people, which is a little disheartening, but hopefully we can get past this.
After the group had been outside McGuire's office for about 30 minutes, the senator's chief of staff, Brett Huber, announced the bill would be scheduled for a floor vote. McGuire later made an appearance of her own.
We just got the bill, so we're going as fast as we can. But it's nice to see all of you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for your passion. I know you have support.
It was 3 a.m. by the time the measure finally reached the floor. Senator Donnie Olson, a Democrat from Golovin, who's a Inupiaq, said the bill would not have made it through the legislature without a groundswell of support.
The elders, the youth, Native and non-native.
Senate Majority Leader John Coghill, a North Pole Republican, took responsibility for the delay in getting the bill to the floor. Coghill explained what he hoped to achieve last week when he proposed amending the bill to create a new category for ceremonial languages.
I thought if you had them in that place of honor, you would aspire to them and honor them, where if you put them in this place, they're more likely to be under tension that I think would be harder to get to the honor and easy to get to divisiveness.
Coghill said he was an apologetic no vote. He added that he would be willing to own up to it if he ends up being proven wrong. Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, was the other senator to vote against the bill. After it passed, supporters gathered outside Senate chambers to embrace each other and shed tears of joy. Twitchell summed up the feeling with a Tlingit phrase.
At 2 o'clock, we succeeded. We obtained.
The bill explicitly says the official language designation does not require the state or local governments to conduct business in languages other than English. But Twitchell said putting them in the same part of the law builds momentum for future generations of native language speakers. If Governor Sean Parnell signs the bill into law, Alaska will become just the second state after Hawaii to officially recognize indigenous languages. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska Airlines has new summer competition in Juneau.
The moment Delta's rubber hits the tarmac in Juneau, fares will be at historic lows.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with former Google Energy Policy Executive Dan Riker on Friday, May 2nd during the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena'ina Center. Hear how Alaska can become a world leader in the fast-growing renewable energy industry. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Lab testing of a synthetic saline solution wrongly used in a University of Alaska Fairbanks medical class shows bacteria. A Houston-based laboratory was hired by the university to analyze samples of demo dose. The solution, which is not intended for humans, was used by UAF Community and Technical College Clinical Procedures class students to practice injections on themselves and one another. UAF spokeswoman Marion Grimes says testing shows it contains bacteria common in water.
They rarely cause any sort of infection in humans. In any cases, or most cases that we found, have occurred in people with weakened immune systems or have been associated with medical devices, such as, they said, intravascular catheters.
Grimes says one of the dozen solution samples tested also contained two additional types of bacteria. About 30 students are known to have received injections of the synthetic saline, which also includes a small amount of isopropyl alcohol. The most common reaction symptoms reported include pain and irritation at injection sites, but Grimes says questions about possible health impacts remain.
We have contracted with a physician at the University of Pennsylvania to offer that kind of information to the physicians of students who go in for testing and things like that.
Grimes says an investigator has been hired to review practices dating back to when the class was first offered in 2006.
That person will be contacting students and speaking to them about their experiences. Very much like we've been gathering that information so far, you know, with whatever students proactively contact us, but the investigator will have a much broader scope.
Grimes says clinical procedures class instructor Sherry Wolf remains on paid leave while the investigation continues.
We don't know exactly why and how it happened. I think that that's one of the things that our investigator is going to try and help us figure out.
UAF officials became aware of what happened after students raised questions this winter. In a letter to the UAF community last week, UAF Chancellor Brian Rogers commends the students for coming forward. Rogers says the situation will take time to sort out, that multiple reviews of class practices and procedures have started or will soon. With an oversupply of natural gas in the country, Alaska is exploring the construction of a relatively small, low-pressure gas line within the state's borders, while still holding out hope for a much larger project should prices improve. Dan Fauske is the president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, or AGDC. He spoke to Sitka's Chamber of Commerce last week about when and where Alaskans may see gas. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The AGDC is the latest attempt by the state to put something, anything, together to promote the construction of a gas line from the North Slope. The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation was established by the legislature in 2010 to explore in-state options for gas, while a more high-profile effort, Governor Sarah Palin's Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA, was trying to connect North Slope gas to markets in the lower 48 through a gas line in Canada. Earlier this year, Governor Parnell announced that the state and TransCanada had called it quits, putting an end to AGIA. Now, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation is the only game in town, and Dan Fauske knows this game has been played time and time again.
We have a plaque in our office. It says Fairbanks to get gas, and it's from the 1954 Daily News Miner. So this debate's been going on a while.
The problem is economic. Natural gas is sold in volumes of 1,000 cubic feet at a price right now somewhere between $3 and $4. To sell gas, it has to be delivered in pressurized pipelines or be supercooled and liquefied. If you're close to the gas, it can be a great deal. The city of Anchorage has been served for decades by low-cost gas from oil refineries next door in Cook Inlet. On the North Slope, where the state has vast reserves of natural gas, Fauske says it's considered a byproduct.
For years, the gas at Prudhoe Bay has been reinjected into the ground and forces the oil out. The petroleum engineers will tell you that we've looked at this gas three or four times. They've recycled it.
The AGDC is exploring a 700-mile gas line from Prudhoe Bay to Nikiski, which would be about 100 miles shorter than a gas line to Valdez, where the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline terminates. There are two options on the table: a 36-inch low-pressure pipeline that would carry so-called lean gas, or gas ready for delivery directly to consumers. The other option is a 42-inch pipeline delivering much higher volumes of gas under much higher pressure. The smaller pipeline would cost almost $8 billion and serve primarily Alaskans. The larger pipeline would cost $65 billion and supply Alaska and the global export market. The big three oil producers, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP, and even TransCanada, would partner with the state and the big pipeline if it ever pencils out. Fauske says this is a big if.
Oil companies are not charged with taking care of the Alaskan citizens. Oil companies do things for their shareholders. And I'm not defending, I'm just saying no one's going to invest in this kind of project so that 700,000 Alaskans can get a benefit. I mean, the reality is they do things for their shareholders. The irony is that the Alaska Permanent Fund is a huge shareholder of Exxon stock. I mean, so people get in the mind that, well, they should have done this. But it's been looked at 30 times.
The state invested $355 million in the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to perform the preliminary engineering and design for the smaller gas line called the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, which will take about 2 years. Fauske believes that sometime in that window, the two projects will meld and the state will ultimately have a 10% stake in a gas line that is operational by 2020. Fauske spent 18 years as the director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation before taking over AGDC. He was on Governor Palin's AGIA team, which he says was a good idea when gas was at $10. His expertise is in finance. The discovery of shale gas in the northern plains of the U.S. undermined AGIA, but Fauske believes this new gas line strategy, based on revenue bonds, is a workable solution for the state's energy needs, as well as the largest construction project in the country. But he says gas is nothing akin to the discovery of oil on the North Slope.
Oil is king. Gas gives us security. But gas will never, from a revenue standpoint, replace oil.
Asked by a member of the chamber audience to give odds on which gas line would be built, Fauske pointed to the radio microphone and TV camera and declined. Instead, he quoted a line from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, and said, something wonderful's going to happen. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
In preparation for daily flights between Juneau and Seattle starting May 29th, Delta Airlines performed test flights in the capital city on Wednesday. For a long time, Alaska Airlines has been the only one flying that route. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, Juneau is set to benefit from the competing partner airlines.
Alaska travel analyst Scott McMurrin says the power of competition goes a long way in lowering airfares.
The moment that Delta's rubber hits the tarmac in Juneau, fares will be at historic lows. This is a great opportunity for Juneau travelers, and that great opportunity will last as long as Delta flies there and not a moment longer.
An online spot check of round-trip flights between Juneau and Seattle in early June showed the airlines offered the same fare, $487. In September, when Delta service ends, flights on Alaska Airlines jump $80. Adding service to Juneau is part of Delta's expansion in Seattle. Right now, the airline makes 35 daily departures out of SeaTac Airport. By August, Delta hopes to increase that to 86 departures. Anthony Black is a Delta spokesman.
We are reaching out to key travel markets that allow us to carry passengers both into Seattle as well to connect them on to international flights. We're adding a significant amount of international service. We just added London Heathrow at the end of March, and we're going to add Hong Kong and Seoul in June.
The airline already flies from Seattle to Amsterdam, Paris, Beijing, Shanghai, and Tokyo. Connecting to international destinations is what Black says will set Delta apart from Alaska Airlines, which only flies internationally to Canada and Mexico.
We have service to a number of domestic markets that are similar to Alaska's markets, but specifically if they're looking to travel internationally, obviously Alaska doesn't have that same level of international service.
Between Juneau and Seattle, Delta will be flying a Boeing 757. Alaska Airlines uses 737s. Black says a 757 can carry more passengers and has more powerful engines. He also says Delta's prices are competitive, and so far Delta is pleased with bookings. Marilyn Romano, regional vice president for Alaska Airlines, says she feels very secure with Alaska's position in Juneau. She says Delta's one flight a day between Juneau and Seattle during the summer doesn't compare with Alaska's eight flights a day.
That's our standard operating business coming in and out of Juneau, and that doesn't include all the other flights that we have, Anchorage to Juneau or Juneau to other cities in southeast Alaska. So as far as competing, I think we feel like we've been operating daily service into Juneau for over four decades.
Plus, there's free baggage if you're a member of Club 49, the airline's program for Alaska residents, and bonus mileage. Travelers flying on Delta from Juneau to Seattle will still get Alaska Airlines miles. While Alaska Airlines and Delta are now competing in Juneau, the two airlines are partners for other destinations.
At times, the competitive nature of our business is bigger than at other times, and this is probably one of those times. And we're doing what we need to do to grow our business, and Delta will do what Delta feels they need to do to grow their business. And at the same time, we are partners. So it's a unique situation.
Juneau International Airport Manager Patty DeLabriere says competition is good for Juneau's economy.
Alaska Airlines, I think, has taken very good care of people up here, but then Delta may add maybe a different flair on what they're going to do for the travelers. So choice is good.
That also means more revenue for the airport, an enterprise of the city and borough of Juneau. Renting space for a check-in counter and offices, flying in and out, and parking its plane overnight in Juneau for the summer will cost Delta about $90,000. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Earth Day will be celebrated with a concert in Fairbanks tomorrow. It's part of a summer-long series of events marking the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act and other environmental laws. KUAC's Tim Ellis has more.
Fairbanks' own Susan Grace has been called the Alaska Troubadour because her songs celebrate the state and its wild places. Grace will share her musical connection to Alaska in a Tuesday evening concert at Pioneer Park that's titled after her most recent album, Forever Wild. The concert is dedicated to the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and it's one of many events that a local environmental group named the Fairbanks Wild 50 will be putting on over the next few months.
This is a year of celebration.
That's Andy Keller. He's a member of Fairbanks Wild 50, and he says his group brought longtime environmental leader Brock Evans to town earlier this month to kick off the 50th anniversary celebration and to talk about the Wilderness Act and other important conservation measures.
Brock just symbolizes really a whole movement to protect land nationally. Brock has been involved in land conservation dating back, my goodness, about half a century.
Evans served in high-profile positions with Audubon and Sierra Club during several conservation campaigns, including the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Evans says it's important to celebrate those measures because they've preserved wild places for both humans and the plants and animals that live there, and they've served as sanctuaries for endangered species. Evans says that's going to be even more important in the years ahead because many more species will become imperiled by the growing threat of climate change.
Climate change is here. It's here now. We're going to have to adapt to it. Human beings are going to have a hard enough time adapting to it, but we can and we will. But wildlife have even a harder time. So saving these wild places is not just for our personal enjoyment, but it's also to protect all the other living creatures around, and especially here in Alaska.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Salmon Love presents the Salmon Haiku Contest through April 30th. Do you have a poetic, funny, and creative Alaska salmon haiku in you like this one? Fresh fry awakens, moving through ripples. Silently, an epic journey blossoms. That's Salmon Love haiku style. Information on how to enter the Salmon Haiku Contest at salmonlove.com. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.